What do you know that makes you healthy? Many of you may have answered exercise. Well, exercise is going to lower our risk of mortality by about 23 to 33%. What about eating fruits and vegetables? So important, so healthy. Eating fruits and vegetables can reduce your risk of death by about 26%. What about the Mediterranean diet? Okay, I'm throwing in some fish, but I'm still getting healthy olive oil. Eating the Mediterranean diet can reduce your risk of death by about 21%. But there is something even deeper that runs through us on a primordial level, and that is the safety and security that can come from having a strong support network of friends and family. Simply having this strong support network can lower our risk of death by about 45%. Even if you don't come from a family that is there to help show you support, volunteering and giving to others can help to reduce your risk of death by about 22 to 44%. Now, of course, we have to take these numbers with a grain of salt, but there's more to being healthy than just the way that we eat and the way that we exercise and the way that we sleep. There is something powerful about how friendship, optimism, and kindness can help us live longer and more exuberant lives. Welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Marcia Zaraska, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Lindsay.
This past year has been a huge transition for all of us, and many people have found themselves spending much and much more time by themselves, alone with their thoughts, which can lead us into spirals of loneliness and depression and anhedonia, where you just don't want to do anything when you don't have the connection with others. Talk to us about why it is so harmful to our psyche and ultimately to our body as a whole to be by ourselves for extended periods of time.
I mean, you know, in general, humans are social apes. We evolved to be part of a tribe. Just look at our cousins, chimpanzees, for instance. You know, they are always surrounded by the other members of their tribe. And in our evolutionary past, if you were alone, it was a sign that things went wrong for you. Basically, it meant that you were ostracized, basically kicked out of the tribe for some reason, or gotten lost, and you were in danger because you were in danger to fall victim to predators. You could have gotten wounded and nobody that would be there to help you. So basically being alone was a dangerous state, and our bodies prepared for that. So when we are alone, we have the special systems that turn on that actually act on the level of our genetic expression. That basically we change into protecting our bodies from being wounded. So inflammation goes up, which is an antibacterial generally response, so that if you do get injured by a predator, your body will heal better. On the other hand, your antiviral response, so it goes down because, you know, our bodies are always trying to conserve energy. So if you are trying to boost something, you usually have to save the energy somewhere else. And it saves it on the antiviral response. But because, as we know it, we catch viruses from other people, right? So if you are alone, this risk goes down. So our antiviral response goes down, which unfortunately in modern times, it means that when you are feeling lonely, you are worse prepared to deal with viruses. Also, you get worse response to vaccination, for instance. There are studies showing that when people are isolated, their bodies don't produce the same levels of antibodies after vaccination, for instance, to flu or hepatitis, than they do if they are not feeling isolated. And on the other hand, your inflammation, so this bacterial protection really is really up. And unfortunately, long-term, inflammation can lead, you know, to plenty of different diseases, from like Alzheimer's, diabetes, cardiovascular problems. So being alone is a natural state for our body, and a state that we recognize as a state of danger.
I think it's so fascinating how you can shift towards genetic expression that primes you for this inflammatory state, as well as a sympathetic state to some extent as well. So you talked about how inflammation can lead to myriad disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and your research is into how does isolation and loneliness lead to accelerated aging, and how does it reduce our longevity? So where we've started is, okay, we're by ourselves, we're turning on our stress signals, and now we've created inflammation. Talk to me a little bit about how the individual who lives in with this long-term state of isolation fares worse when it comes to chronic disease and it comes to dying early and all of the things that it seems we're all trying to avoid.
Yeah, so for instance, you know, research shows that people who are chronically isolated, they are at a 2.5 higher risk of premature death, for instance. They also have shorter telomeres, so those protective caps at the ends of your chromosomes that take important part in aging. They have exactly higher inflammation levels, they have higher blood pressure as well, and as we've mentioned before, they respond worse to vaccination. So there is plenty of things going on when you're isolated. But an important thing to recognize here as well, which is, I think, particularly vital in pandemic times, that it's all about how you measure loneliness. And generally in research, when scientists are trying to establish whether somebody is isolated and lonely, the questions they ask is there someone in your life that you can count on? Is there someone that would help you if you're sick? Is there someone who would bring you soup in the middle of the night kind of thing? Is there someone who would drive you to the doctor, to the airport? Is there someone you can call if you're feeling down? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then generally you are not isolated, you are not lonely, which actually is good news from the pandemic perspective, because even though we are often physically isolated from our friends, we still know, you know, if you have friends like that, you know they are still there, and you know they would still drop you that soup at your doorstep, even if they couldn't, you know, physically see you, they could still do that, and they could still, you know, they could still help you, you could still call them. So it's not exactly the type of loneliness and isolation that usually in research is showed as very detrimental to health. This kind of isolation is when you really know there is no one there who would help you, to whom you can call. There is nobody in whom you can confide, right? But if you have friends, even in pandemic, you can always call them, you can Zoom them, you can Skype them. There are options, right? So this is not exactly the same thing we are seeing. Even though, you know, not being physically with our friends is also difficult, that's certain. You know, we are physical creatures, and for instance, when we touch, when we hug, when we look directly into each other's eyes, we get this boost of social hormones such as oxytocin, for instance, the so-called love hormone. So there are things happening when we are in physical contact as well, which is also important for health, but it's not as detrimental as this kind of isolation when we're talking about not having anybody at all in your life.
So one of the things that breaks down under chronic stress and chronic inflammation is resiliency against disease, as we've talked about extensively. What it sounds like that you're talking about is an internal awareness that there is someone I can connect with, even if it is not physical. There are ways that I can reach out to people, that I can maintain these safe and loving connections, versus not having that at all and just feeling completely completely alone and abandoned and whatever other words that you want to use. I'm always interested in how do we create resilience, even in the times of stress? How do we create resilience so that even when we are physically alone and we can't touch people, we can't look a ton of people directly into the eyes, what are things that we can do in the day to day that help us to maintain connection?
I think it's most important the realization that you need to do that, right? And it's extremely important for your both your mental health and your physical health. So just don't, you know, just assume that you cannot have your life as usual. So you just give up. You have to find creative ways of connecting. And, you know, and I myself, you know, I have been seeing my girlfriends in outside, outdoors, in masks, in the most horrible weather. It's one time, you know, we stood out there in this horrible wind that was breaking our umbrellas and it was raining sideways. And we're keeping the 2 meter distance outdoors, but we really still wanted to meet, you know. So this is really about, if you really want to, you can still find ways. And sure, you know, it's difficult. It's not the same as sitting nicely on the couch together in the warmth of your house, but it's still so important to connect that even exactly if it's windy and rainy and the only way to do it is outdoors, you know, keeping safe distance, it still makes sense because it's so important for both your mental health and your physical health. And, you know, even making sure to call instead of texting. There is research showing that when you text people, you don't get the same amount of oxytocin boost. So this laugh hormone, once again, that you get from calling people, from hearing their voice. And oxytocin, it doesn't only make you feel all warm and lovey. It actually has direct physical effects on our body. So it can potentially prevent inflammation. It has some effects on bone growth. It has pain reducing properties. So there are lots of things happening, you know, when you actually hear the voice instead of just, you know, texting on your phone. So really trying to reach out in all the creative ways, the ways that you can find it, just making sure to find time for the connection.
Finding time is so important. And like you said at the very beginning, you have to accept and understand that this is a part of how we stay healthy. Now, I have on my wall back behind me, show up, work hard, and be kind. And you talk a lot about how kindness can also impact our longevity. So talk to me about what is your definition of kindness and what are the health benefits of expressing it, doing it, being aware of it, all of the things.
Yeah, so, you know, there is plenty of research showing that basically helping others, whether it's in a formal way, such as in volunteering or even donating money or doing very simple acts of kindness, actually impact our physical health. And some of the processes are, once again, through lowering of our stress response, basically caring for others. Calms us down. We evolved that way so that we could be actually able to care for our children. So because when you are panicking, when you're extremely stressed, you are not a good caregiver, basically. So our nature made sure that when you are caring for other people, your stress response goes down. So the activity, for example, of certain brain parts, such as the amygdala, the fear center, goes down so that you are calmer and you are better at caring. And this has beneficial effects on our health. So for instance, you know, people who volunteer, they have lower inflammation levels, they have lower blood glucose levels, they spend fewer nights in hospitals, they generally live longer. But even simple acts of kindness, such as, you know, for instance, buying coffee for a stranger or letting someone ahead in traffic, such things can also have effects on our health. And there was this one fascinating research in where scientists actually randomized people into two separate groups. And one of the groups was supposed to do this random acts of kindness for a period of, I think, 4 weeks. And these were exactly the very, very small things, as I've mentioned before. And afterwards, when they took all the health checks, and they actually also kept taking blood samples from them, they discovered that their gene expression in their white blood cells changed exactly once again. It was more turned towards inflammation, so they were less prone to inflammation, but their antiviral response went up. So you can see that even such small things as random acts of kindness can actually change you on the level of genetic expression, which for me is absolutely fascinating.
It is so fascinating. And I'd love if you could break this down for us in really simple terms, because oftentimes when it comes to energy work or earthing or trying to commune with nature, to do deep breathing exercises, we do these things. We somehow have this innate understanding that they help us, and yet how it actually happens that people can go from being angry or miserly or depressed or lonely and simply say, okay, look, every single day I'm going to do at least one simple kind thing for someone else. I'm going to open a door. I'm going to, you know, not blow my horn in traffic, whatever that is. But how, on a scientific level, what do we really know about kind of the frontiers of how that changes gene expression? I think we all kind of understand how it can change our neurotransmitters and calm down our heart rate, but how does it change gene expression in a simple way?
I mean, you know, so it's basically about turning certain genes on and off, right? So it turns your genes that are responsible for antiviral response up, and then turns the other ones for inflammation, you could say, down, right, or off, like a light switch kind of thing. And it happens exactly because all those systems in our bodies are interconnected, right? So when we are talking about those social hormones I've mentioned before, such as oxytocin, but you have other ones like serotonin, endorphins, vasopressin, then we have all the stress networks, right? Stress axis, such as the HPA axis, for instance, or the sympathetic nervous system, and it's all interconnected, right? So we have these brain regions that are connected to the stress response system, that are connected to the hormones. There's also the cortisol and adrenaline, and then it's also connected to your gene expression. So it's all kind of all working together. Even our gut microbiome, right, which is something that connects our emotions and our social lives and our health, also is connected to our system of the stress response and to the social hormones. So our bodies are this amazing network of interconnections that we are just starting to uncover and understand how it all interacts and works together. And certainly, for example, we know that acts of kindness lower cortisol response. So if you perform a lot of acts of kindness, your cortisol response, so the stress hormone response, becomes healthier. I've actually experienced it myself. I conducted kind of an experiment on myself with scientists from King's College London, and where I was performing acts of kindness on certain days, on other ones where I was just living my life as usual, and we were measuring my cortisol levels 3 times a day to exactly establish how the levels of that stress hormone change throughout the week. And we have actually noticed an amazing difference between the days on which I was performing kindness and all the other days, independent of the actual levels of stress in my daily life on those days. You could really see that when I was doing the acts of kindness, my stress response was much healthier. The scientists were really surprised to see how much of a difference actually it made. So you know, and there are other, of course, much more really sciencey studies, because, you know, sample of one is not very scientific, but there are proper big research studies as well done on big samples of people showing exactly that kindness can impact our cortisol response.
I love it, because what you just said was so profound, because the N of one, of course, it's not scientifically validated and cannot be published in a peer-reviewed journal, but you saw the benefits yourself in your life, how it applies to you. And the thing that I take the most hope from in what you just said is that it happened in real time. This isn't something that you're talking about that you've got to do this for 6 months before you see any kind of benefit. This is something that can happen in real time. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Putting gratitude into practice in your everyday life is simple. I've got a new free download for you over at cleanslatecleanse.com. It's a 28-day guide that will step you through 28 days of gratitude. All you have to do is write down something that you are grateful for each day. I'd like for you to focus in your gratitude in things about your body, your cooking routine, your diet routine that you are really grateful for. Take time to find the moments to celebrate when you're grateful for a beautiful home-cooked meal that was nourishing. Maybe even take time to be grateful for those meals that were celebratory, where you had so much joy and love that abounded. One of the things I know to be true in my life is that when I practice gratitude, it helps me to keep a mindset that enables me to make better choices on every single level. We know that gratitude can help our physical health. People who practice gratitude are more likely to give thanks for the meals that they eat, to thank the people around them who are preparing those meals. Giving gratitude surrounding how we eat helps us to broaden our minds and think about the farmers, the soil, the animals, the world around us, that we are a part of the ecosystem. I'd love for you to head over to cleanslatecleanse.com/gratitude. Download the free gratitude handout and you will have 28 days of food-focused ideas on things that you can be grateful for. It's one step in the right direction for your health. And now, let's get back to the show. Now, I have spoken to my audience before. The concept of an ikigai was brought up to me on another podcast that I was on, and I found it totally fascinating. And we did a segment here on the show of me talking about what thought processes did I go through trying to fill out an ikigai. I would love to hear your perspective on why you, and traditionally why do the Japanese think that the ikigai is so important to health. So define it for us and then tell us how it's going to make us healthier.
Sure. So definitely, you know, I traveled to research growing young. I traveled to Japan as well, because this is the longest lived nation right now on the planet. So I wanted to talk to scientists there and also to elderly people, including some centenarians, about their secrets or their understanding of what makes them live so long. And ikigai, so this concept of a reason for living, supposedly it's very hard to translate into English. I don't speak Japanese, but the closest supposedly is the reason for living, which sometimes it gets translated into purpose in life or meaning in life. It's a related concept. And for them, this is one of the main predictors of longevity. Even the Ministry of Health of Japan, when they talk about what makes certain people live longer, they talk, of course, about diet and exercise, but also about ikigai, really, you know, put it in a prominent spot. And they have conducted quite a lot of research as well, showing that people who have this kind of ikigai in their life, that this reason for living, that they actually have especially much lower rates of cardiovascular disease, which in turn makes them live longer too, right? Because if you don't suffer heart attacks and generally cardiovascular disease, you tend to live longer. And similar research conducted in the West on our related concepts of purpose in life or meaning has also shown that people who have that live longer. They also, for instance, suffer less Alzheimer's disease, Again, cardiovascular disease, much lower levels. So there is a lot of happening beneficial in your body if you do find the kind of meaning and purpose. But an important thing to understand here that, you know, when you talk about ikigai with Japanese people, they usually don't mention any grand things. They don't talk about, you know, saving the elephants or things like that, even though it would make a perfect ikigai, you know, don't get me wrong. But they usually name much smaller things. For instance, taking care of my grandchildren or keeping my front yard pretty so that my neighbors can enjoy it. Really, really very small down-to-earth things. And so I believe that, you know, really everybody can find something in their life that can give them this kind of reason for living. But another important thing here is that this ikigai or meaning or purpose in life generally has to be something connected to others. I've been asked by someone whether golf can be your ikigai. And generally, you know, the answer is unfortunately no. It has to be something that you give back to the community. You give back something to others, you know, exactly caring for your grandchildren or, you know, just taking care of your garden, but so that the neighbors can find it pleasing. Baking cookies for your family so they can enjoy them. Anything like that, that you give away, you help others. And ikigai is also the reason why, for instance, in Japan, it's very common for people of retirement age to actually keep working, but they stop working at their usual jobs. And instead, they go to special employment agencies, which are called the silver hair employment agencies. And they find themselves post-retirement jobs, which are usually very simple, usually part-time occupations, such as, you know, keeping public garden spaces, you know, or helping children cross on the way to school. And we are talking about people, for example, I talk to people who are, you know, really high up in some corporations, who are managers, who are bankers, and then they go on and they become public space gardeners. And for them, they don't do it for the money. They just do it to be still involved in the community, to be useful, and to exactly have this kind of ikigai. And in Japan, there is a very common perception that this also helps them live longer and stay healthy.
I love it because the way that I was explained the ikigai, it's about trying to find an intersection between what you're good at, what people will pay you to do, what gives back to the greater community. And what you're saying is most of the time what people actually express as their ikigai is those small things. My grandmother recently passed away, and it's inspired me, encouraged me to really think about the meaning of life. And the more I recognize that when you can put small amounts of gratitude on the simple, down-to-earth things that make you a better person and the world around you a slightly better place, I think the happier that you'll be. And one of the things you mentioned in the ikigai is you said, look, when you have this reason for living, it gives you something more. We have diet and exercise, and in looking at your website for Growing Young, you have a lot of statistics about mortality risk of being around friends and family and having a strong support network. It's actually more beneficial to you. You are less likely to die if you have that strong support network than if we're exercising like crazy or really being just dead set that we must have this many fruits and vegetables or eat in this same way. What do you think it is that is it simply going back to exactly where we started, that this is just something so deeply primal within us? What is that what it is? That's why it's more. Tell us more about why you think this is so hard-coded and why more people aren't paying attention to it if it is so critical to our survival.
I mean, certainly, you know, as I've mentioned before, we are the social species, extremely social species. humans. And so it is a very basic thing for us. And it is, you know, it is correct that being socially integrated, so having friends, being close with your family, having a romantic partner, knowing your neighbors, all this taken together, research shows that it can have a higher impact on lowering your mortality risk than diet and exercise, which is not to say that diet and exercise are not important, because they are important, but, you know, this is even more. So, of course, in the best case scenario, you will be having both friends and being integrated in your community and eating healthy and exercising. But also the thing is that, you know, sometimes we are in modern times a little bit too obsessive about diet and exercise. We go far too much into it. You know, I know people who, for instance, prepare for Ironman or marathons so much that they actually abandon their friends and don't have enough time for their family. And if you are doing that, then probably the balance is not good, because you can still exercise, you can exercise less and spend more time with your family to find exactly the benefit of both. But if you are, you know, spending too much time either on your diet or, you know, finding some perfect foods for yourself or exactly exercise, and the cost is your community, your kindness, and all the other things, then this is not a good balance in your life. And the other question that you asked me is, why aren't we talking about that? And this is also something that absolutely fascinated me when I started researching Growing Young, is how is that possible that there is so much research on that? Because I've read over 600 papers to write that book. And this research is going back for decades. You know, how is that there is so much on that topic, and yet it somehow doesn't make it to popular media? And for me, the answer is that there is nothing for anybody there to sell you. You know, when we are talking about diet and exercise, there are plenty of products out there that are being sold to us. There are, you know, there are some supplements and some miracle foods and special, you know, manuka honey, whatever things that you can buy. There are exercise gadgets and exercise classes and apps and all that stuff that is being pushed to you. And you can see ads, there are influencers, you know, on Instagram selling you things and so on and so on. So it's being marketed. Whereas when we're talking about kindness, you know, it's kind of hard. How is anybody going to make money on that? On you, you know, opening doors for someone to let them into a store, or you not honking in traffic? You know, there is no money to be made on you taking a walk with your friends. And this is why it didn't really make it so much into our common knowledge, into the social media and everywhere else.
It's so sad, because oftentimes one of the biggest objections to living a healthy life is that it is too expensive. And oftentimes the most impactful things can be inexpensive, or as you were just discussing, free and readily available to us all of the time. You know, your book is so fascinating, because it's about how friendship, optimism, and kindness can help you live to 100. And we live in a very, it seems, pessimistic world. It seems we get bombarded with a lot of negativity throughout social media. And as you say, you know, the media is skewed towards what is ultimately going to sell, because it costs money to produce the media and somebody pays for it and those people have to sell things. It's a cycle. What are you truly optimistic about right now?
I mean, I'm generally trying to be an optimist. I have to admit that these days, you know, with the pandemic and everything, is a little bit harder to stay optimistic, but I'm trying. You know, I just think that if we stop reading so much news and going on the media so much, and I am trying myself to limit them, and then you can start breathing again and seeing the bright side of things. And it's just about choosing also exactly your diet media diet, right? Like the way we eat certain things, that you should also pay attention to what you consume in terms of your news and media exposure. You know, in the way we have junk food, you can also say we have junk news when you are reading all this negative stuff that just is bad for you. You know, there is research showing that negative media can affect your stress response again. And this can actually have downstream health effects. There are actually studies showing that the people watch a lot of very disturbing news, later on they will suffer more health problems. So it actually is important what you are consuming on social media and generally how much time you spend reading news, and especially in pandemic times when there is so much disturbing stuff out there. It's very important to be careful about how much time you spend there and what you're reading, and to read only high quality news, and they tend to be less negative, the high quality media outlets.
Absolutely. And I'm going to take you back, and I'm going to challenge you a little bit, because it is harder to stay optimistic. But what are you in your life genuinely optimistic about right now? You know, I mean, like, I think it's important for us to share, what do we have on the horizon? As you said, it's so important to focus on the positive. So what has given you joy in the recent days?
I mean, you know, exactly. I try to always connect with my community and, you know, just be kind to people. So my daughter's best friend's family is currently sick. I mean, they're not sick. They have COVID. They have no symptoms, but they're currently in isolation. So we make sure, you know, to always bring them food and to call them and to check on them all the time. So, you know, just being connected to their our neighbors, but, you know, so always being there for others. And it's really makes you feel better. You know, you do something for another person, but you benefit, I think, the most yourself, because it just feels good. And just fostering this kind of connections, you know, even if the only way you can talk with your neighbors is through the window, you know, at a distance, it's still important and it still makes you feel better. Or like I mentioned before, meeting my girlfriends in the most horrible weather, it still makes you feel better, right? So
yes,
trying to make sure to do these kind of things, even though pandemic can make us sometimes feel like we just want to, you know, crawl under the bed and stay there, that it's still important to reach out and try and connect with your community.
Absolutely. It's so wonderful when we can remember that it really is the little things that count. It's the thought that counts. It's the small action that counts. And it's the focus on the gratitude and joy and love that can come out of the seemingly mundane. I have loved talking to you today, Marta. Thank you so much for sharing your wealth of knowledge and for writing your book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, for having me on your show.
Many of us try to make health and wellness so complicated. Let's stop doing that and instead take control of our health with 5 simple steps. When you head to lindsayelmore.com/5pillars, that's lindsayelmore.com/5pillars, you will get 5 simple steps that help you to eliminate the crap from your environment, take ownership and control of your detoxification pathways, craft intentional relaxation, nourish your body, and exercise regularly. We'll take all of those steps and create 1 comprehensive plan that helps you to take control of your health. Head to lindsayelmore.com/5pillars now for your free downloadable. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Kelsey Lorman. Production design, sound design, and editing is by Jive Media. If you have a question about this or any other episode of the podcast, send us an email to hello@lindsayelmoreshow.com. And hey, since you're still here, take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And while you're at it, go over and follow us on Instagram @LindsayElmoreShow. This helps us bring the pod to more people.